You're listening to Rendezvous with a Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet, and story is everything. We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell, and you just were listening to the Hot Texas Swing Band doing Hot Texas.
We're so delighted that you're joining us tonight, again this week, whether you're listening live or watching live right now, or you're catching this on the podcast, which will go up shortly this evening on Podbean and Spotify and Amazon Music and so. We're just happy to have you with us. So, honey, who are our guests tonight?
Special guest, Henry Park, film editor of True West Magazine, and special guest, Michael F. Blake, noted author, and we're going to be talking about his book tonight, The Cowboy Trilogy, which is John Wayne, John Ford, and the making of three classic westerns.
And Henry, of course, is the editor, film editor for True West Magazine. This is the most recent copy. And both of you gentlemen are kind of throughout this whole magazine. We just kept seeing things about Michael and things about Henry. And of course, also the author of a book that was published earlier, last fall, The Greatest Westerns Ever Made and the People Who Made Them. So two great friends and film historians with us tonight. So welcome. Why don't you just start real quickly? Where are you each joining us from? Henry, where are you?
Oh, I'm in Van Nuys, California, where it's 100 degrees exactly. Outside. I'm not in here, thank goodness.
And Michael, where are you tonight?
I'm 35 miles west of Phoenix, Arizona. And last I checked, it was 114.
Yeah, that's warm.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm cooking some eggs on the sidewalk as we speak.
I was thinking.
Well, we are in New Mexico. It's actually, we've had a little bit of a cooling trend the last couple of days.
Yeah, we're probably, in this time of night, we're probably down about 92.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're cool here.
Yeah. But we're on for hot topics tonight. We're very excited to have you both with us. Remind us, we've known each other all for a very long time, but how did you two meet, Henry and Michael?
Well, you want to take
Well, sure. Now, I was trying to think, has it been 10 years ago that we were both in, we met in Griffith Park. That sounds strange.
Yeah.
But we were both
through there. So,
yeah. But we were both there to be interviewed by TCM people who were doing a documentary on called Western Fanatics. And for some reason, they picked us.
Yeah. And we had to sit off to the side of the road while they set up the camera and app. And unfortunately, Henry and I had nothing to talk about. We didn't like Westerns.
No, nothing in common. It was so sad.
It was deathly silent there talking about movies. I have to say one thing. Henry said something in that TCM thing that has stuck with me ever since and is so wonderfully spot on. He said, if there is a Citizen Kane for Western films, I'm paraphrasing here, it's Stagecoach. And he is absolutely positively right on the button with that.
Yeah. When you were having that interview in Griffith Park, it sounds like you were actually, like you were not at the Autry Museum.
No, we were literally in the wilds of Griffith Park. I sat on a rock. they spared no expense.
But I stood next to a tree.
Oh, and my goodness.
The way it's up, all who you know.
Yeah. On the way up to where we were, a rattlesnake driving to the location, a rattlesnake literally crossed my path on the road.
Oh, my gosh. Mm. Oh, my gosh. Well, and then
interviewed the snake. Yeah. Yeah.
And, of course, we both met you independently through the Santa Clarita Cowboy Festival. Yep. Nice. And the Buckaroo Bookshop. And, Michael, I think one year, you know, they used to do a movie, like on Friday night, they took the main street and they showed a film. And you maybe did commentary, or you introduced the film.
I introduced High Noon.
Introduced High Noon.
Yeah,
because this book was very important, as I recall.
Yes. Out of print. My dad literally has the first spoken line in High Noon. As the bad guys ride into town, they pass him and the other guys standing in front of the saloon. You know, my dad says, "Come on, open up. We're going to have a big day today." And then later, Gary Cooper punches him, which I always live vicariously to teenager.
My goodness. I know that you want to ask them something, honey. You got a good question?
Well, the question, I guess we can ask each one here. We were talking about Horizon the other day.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you want to comment on that? I know, Henry, you saw it. Did you see it too, Michael?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Yes, I did. I liked it. There were a few things. Trying to follow the characters, it jumped around a little bit. So you really had to concentrate. But I really enjoyed it. Beautifully shot. The sequence of the Apaches attacking this tent town was not only beautifully filmed, but absolutely, completely exact what the Apaches would have done. The only exception being is they would have hit and then taken off. But for cinematic purposes, Kevin extended the attack a little bit longer to build up the drama. But I really enjoyed it. And, I read your comment the other day, Henry, about you and one other guy were at the theater in North Hollywood. When we went to see it, it was about 50% full, and everybody was probably, I think the average age was 40 years old and up. When the movie ended, I was the only one that applauded. So I don't know if everybody else just felt like they got to get out and hit the bathroom because the running time. But you want to talk about the what happened with the movie since then, Henry?
Well, I certainly will. I was just going to say that for me, I thought it was a terrific movie. I was very impressed. I found it amazing that, at the Cannes Film Festival, it got a 7-minute standing ovation. And then all the reviewers that were there applauding for 7 minutes said, "It's okay." You know, it's really seems like people have it in for Costner.
Maybe that's it.
To some degree, because I think he left Yellowstone and they're mad about that. But I think it's a beautiful a piece of filmmaking. And it's funny because to me, too, my absolute favorite thing in the whole movie is what's going on in that cabin during that Apache attack. I just thought that I would have paid twice what I paid just to see that sequence.
Yeah.
Wow.
Just beautifully done. The big problem I see with it, or one of the problems in terms of why it's not doing as well as everyone had hoped, is because the story, because it's told as, you know, the first of four parts, so much of it is set up. And it does not have the beginning, middle, and an end that we're used to. You sort of have to go in accepting you're going to get 25% of the story. But boy, is there plenty. And in spite of the fact that it was 3 hours and 1 minute, when it ended, my immediate reaction was, that was 3 hours? Because it just flew by.
Wow. Wow.
No, was there an intermission at all?
No.
Really? Okay.
Oh, and by the way, when I was there, there were only two of us, but we both applauded like mad.
Well, since then, the news broke yesterday as you know, Henry, that the second part, which was supposed to be playing in theaters next month, they pulled. Right. So what I have to say, I'm not surprised, but I'm disappointed. But I think I understand what they want to do. It is supposed to go into pay on video demand starting the 16th of this month. And like my theater, they had it for 2 weeks. Tonight's the last night they're showing it. And but other theaters in the Phoenix area, some of the other theaters of this theater chain are showing it. I think what they want, what they're hoping is if they do the video on demand, they'll get more people, which I can understand because I have to admit, going to a movie theater is kind of a pain in the neck for me now. You know, I'm just so set in staying home and I don't have to deal with trying to find a parking place like I did and then walking 115 degree heat from the car to the theater. But it's also, it's just easier for those of us who have weaker bladders that if we're home watching it, we can pause the movie. We don't miss anything. Just come back and charge right up.
Yeah.
And also I've heard later this year, there's no date yet, but I did see some artwork on Digital Bits that is going to come out on I'm going to say DVD. It could be DVD, Blu-ray, 4K. I don't know, but the disc. I call it DVD.
Okay.
So,
all right.
I think they're hoping to build it up more, get more people to see it, and they keep saying they're going to release it part two theatrically, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, I think what the hope is that. When they start streaming the part one, the one we have seen, that will create enough interest that they'll be able to theatrically release the second one. Mm-hmm. That will make sense. Because I think one of the problems that nobody sort of foresaw is there has been this great resurgence of interest in the Western. Most of it tied to Taylor Sheridan and Kevin Costner, of course.
Right.
But it's been an entirely staying at home thing. The few Westerns that have come out lately theatrically haven't done much business. Now, they haven't been much in the way of Westerns either, so it hadn't struck anyone. But the thing is, this great resurgence came during COVID. Yeah. And Westerns do tend to skew older, and they tend to skew rural, and so these things are not doing well in the cities. I've been talking, on the other hand, to people in I've been talking to people in Bakersfield, Pittsburgh, and the Netherlands. Yes, and they have all had pretty crowded theaters, like three quarters full.
Interesting.
One of the trade papers said, you know, with this story breaking, that the movie has done well in the Southwest, the South, and Middle America.
Right.
I'd be real curious to see when and how it does when it goes to Japan, because they love Westerns.
They sure do.
Yeah, how interesting. Yeah. Well, gentlemen, let's jump forward a little bit. Thank you for that. We've not seen it yet, and I know we got to check now and find out where it is
and how long
it's playing in our area. I think this weekend we better figure out where to go. I want to see it on the big screen. So, Henry, give us a little bit of a Henry's Western roundup. What else is going on in Western film these days? Anything else to report?
Well, yeah, if I can just yap a little about me.
Sure.
For anyone who's in Southern California, this Saturday, I'm going to be at the Autry Museum. At 1:30, I'll be introducing the movie News of the World, which is another really fine Western that did not get the theatrical release it should have because of COVID. Oh, and afterwards, I'll be signing copies of my book, The Greatest Westerns Ever Made, and the people who made them.
A damn fine book, by the way.
Thank you all very much. Yeah, and that coming from you, that is quite a compliment. I thank you very much for that.
Well, just send the check and that'll be fine.
Okay, I'm going to Venmo it. Yeah. as soon as I find out what that means.
Yeah.
Henry's book is really, really good. Damn fine.
Thank you. Well, I've been doing on-camera introductions for 8 Westerns for the Scottsdale Museum of the West. They have a matinee every Thursday and Sunday. I've got, as you've been talking about, what I've got in True West this month, and I'll mention on the INSP's blog, my newest article is about the President Ronald Reagan movie, Cavalry Charge. And anyway, we've talked about the big Western news, of course, which is the disappointment of the business of Costner's film, Horizon, Part 1. So here's some good news. There are a couple of new indie Westerns currently in production. Where the Wind Blows will star Trevor Donovan and Ashley Elaine and C. Thomas Howell, who has quite a career in Westerns, and Broken Trail starring Jeff Fahey, who is terrific in Horizon.
Oh, yeah.
Rumor Willis and Graham Greene. And no, it is not a remake of the Robert Duvall classic, Broken Trail. And I wish they wouldn't do that. I wish they wouldn't use that title. Mm-hmm. I love the Burt Lancaster, John Huston film, The Unforgiven, and I love Clint Eastwood's film, Unforgiven. But if you're not doing a remake, why reuse the title?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
And because we've covered, I think we have covered Horizon. So let me just say that you can read all about this and so much more at www.henryswesternroundup.blogspot.com.
Your major article, we'll be talking about this film very shortly. I don't know. When we decided to invite both of you for this date, we didn't have any idea that everything that we were talking about would just all be encapsulated
really
in this issue.
Yeah. It's kismet.
Yeah. So now, Michael, we're going to kind of turn to you. Jim has a short bio he's going to introduce you with, and then we're going to get to know a little bit more about Michael F. Blake.
Okay. Michael F. Blake spent 60 years in the film and TV industry, retiring in 2018. For 20 years, he was a child actor on such shows as Adam 12, The Lucy Show, The Munsters, Bonanza, and Kung Fu. At the age of 21, he began a 4-year career as a makeup artist, and he won 2 Emmys. His credits include Westworld, Tough Guys, X-Men, and Independence Day. He has written 8 books on subjects ranging from silent screen star Lon Chaney to the films of The Gunfight, of the O.K. Corral, and Teddy Roosevelt. Michael is a recipient of 2 Western Writers of America Stirrup Awards and a gold medal for the Will Rogers Medallion Awards for writing. Very good. Welcome, Michael.
And if you go by Forest Lawn Cemetery in Glendale, you'll hear a loud spinning noise. That's my high school English teacher spinning in her grave. Horrible, horrible student.
Yeah, I was going to say, she didn't think you'd make it, right?
Well, you have a very interesting background. And although we have a lot to talk about tonight with your new book, your background's fascinating. Would you just share a little bit about yourself and movies and your dad, and just give us some background, Michael?
Okay. Well, my dad started out in between my dad and myself, the years in the business, we've spent 100 years in the business.
Wow.
My dad started out in vaudeville as an impersonator, became a headliner, played the Roxy Theater, the Rainbow Room. And he was offered 3 screen tests, one from RKO, MGM, Universal, and he chose Universal. And he was under contract to Universal from 1936 to 1939. He was in the sequel to All Quiet on the Western Front called The Road Back. And the movie didn't do well because of things happening in Germany and that, and Universal had to really cut it to appease the German country. And so when Hitler invaded Poland, they brought my dad back, and he was the first American actor to play Hitler in a movie, because they added scene of Hitler to tie in. It still didn't do any good. Unfortunately, my dad had a drinking problem and one day went into Universal and told him, take your contract and stick it. Then the war came and he went into the Navy, and he was going to get, he was in the North Atlantic on a tin ship called the a destroyer. And he was going to get dishonorably discharged because of his alcoholism. And my grandmother from Ireland walked into one of the U.S. Navy offices in New York. No idea what she said, but they transferred Dad to the Pacific, where he helped put the battleship Iowa into commission. They gave him an honorable discharge, sent him to a hospital up in Oakland to try to help him get sober. And while he was there, he had a variety for the Marines and the Navy. And in the audience was a Jesuit priest who knew my dad's backstory.
Oh, my gosh. And
he said, yeah, your dad told a joke about the Catholics I didn't appreciate. And he said, from that point, he said, he's mine. He went after my dad. And, of course, Dad kept saying, oh, I don't have a problem, don't have a problem. One day, Father Corley grabbed him by the shirt collar, slammed him against the wall and said, I am willing to take off this collar and give up my priestly vows if it'll get you sober. And Dad, being an Irish Catholic, he got on AA. 1947, he started the first motion picture AA group with Louis Alberni in a small building outside of studios. And he was on the program up until he passed away. And he kept working. He was in Sunset Boulevard, High Noon, Earth versus the Flying Saucers. That's where he plays the motorcycle cop where the Martians take his brain. And I always said, yeah, they didn't give it either. And he did the pilot of Gunsmoke. You know, and he worked a lot for Lucy. And so when I was two, I told my folks I wanted to be an actor. And if you believe that, I got great beachfront property. So they put me in commercials and started getting some TV stuff and kept doing it. And thankfully, I was never successful because, honestly, I think my dad was trying to make me the new Larry Blake, to make me what he wanted to be. And didn't get a chance. And if I had been successful, he would have been the stage mother from hell. And when I was 10, he was on, they ran Man of a Thousand Faces on the Late Show. So I stayed up to watch my dad over. I wanted to know who this Lon Chaney was and what's makeup. I wanted a makeup case. Well, 3 years later, I'm doing a Marcus Welby, and I was on it for like 5 days, so I bugged one of the makeup guys. What's this in your kit? How does this work? What is this? Took me up to the makeup lab. I saw the creature from the Black Lagoon suit. All these things. Anyway, on my last day, he gave me his old makeup case filled with pan sticks and pancakes. Yeah. Like that. I went home, made up all the blonde-haired kids with a Cary Grant tan. I started teaching myself. I got books from the library, and if I worked on a show, I had pictures of me in various makeups because nobody else would sit for me. And some makeup guys were really great. They'd say, oh, that's good. But here, why don't you try this? And they'd show me tricks. Other guys said, get away from me. I don't want to talk to you. Anyway, when I was 21, I took my portfolio over to Universal to show the makeup guy. And he took me down to meet the department head. And 6 months later, in October of 1978, I started at Universal. And my first 3.5 years were at Universal. And when they closed the department, started, you know, freelancing. And was always interested in Chaney, collected a lot of memorabilia on him. And I wanted to write a book. And my first 3 pages were horrible. Absolute garbage, because I tried to sound biographical. The most boring piece of junk you ever read. And a friend of mine said, well, look, you know, when you talk about Chaney, you talk like you know him. Why don't you try that? And that's how I found my voice as a writer. Mm-hmm. One Chaney book, and then I met these relatives of Lon's business manager, and they said, well, we got a few things. Well, it completely rewrote the history of the Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Oh, wow.
And then more people came through and said, hey, you ought to talk to this guy that's alive and talk to this lady. And so in typical Hollywood fashion, I did a second book. And then I did a third book, The Films of Lon Chaney. Then I thought it was over. And then I got the brilliant idea to do the book on the making of High Noon, Chaney and the Searchers.
Mm-hmm.
And then did the Hollywood and the OK Corral. And honestly, I thought that was going to be it. And then came along to Theodore Roosevelt books.
Well, we are going to take a very short break. And when we come back, we will be in depth the whole rest of our time together about this brand new book, The Cavalry Trilogy, John Ford, John Wayne, and the making of three classic Westerns. But before we do that, here is a quick word on where you can find all of Michael's books and Henry's book. And it is on our Out West Shop affiliate, bookshop.org page, and here's all about it. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. Special guests Henry Park and Michael F. Blake. We're just now talking about Michael's book, The Cavalry Trilogy. So let's first, what do we want to talk about? Fort Apache? Something like
that? Yeah, so let's just get right into it. My first question is, what drew you to write about these three films? Why did their stories need to be told, Michael?
Well, in most Wayne books and Ford biographies, they cover him, but it's very short. You know, they might tell one, two, three stories at the most because, you know, word count is always the writer's worst enemy. And The Searchers and She Wore a Yellow Ribbon are my two favorite John Ford films. And I wanted to write about it because I thought there's a lot more to it than what people have said. And I just started digging and got very, very lucky. It was an easy process for me because I loved the subject matter so much that it wasn't a chore writing. You know, sometimes you have to write about stuff and go, oh God, what am I going to do? How am I going to make this interesting? But if you write about something that you truly love, that comes from your heart, it may be juggling three chainsaws at once because you got to keep all your facts and that together. But it was so much fun writing about for me.
Mm-hmm. So the first movie cover in the book is Fort Apache. So let's start there.
Okay.
What would you like to tell us about Fort Apache?
Well, this was the second, and Marion C. Cooper had produced through their company, Argus Productions. Like a lot of directors after the war, they wanted artistic freedom. They had just fought all these dictators, and the last thing they wanted to do was deal with somebody like a Jack L. Warner, you know, who was a dictator on doing stuff. They wanted the freedom. And with Ford and Cooper, they also looked ahead because they thought, well, if we can own our films, we can re-release them down the road, get more money than the studio having it. And also, they were kind of looking at, you know, somewhere down the line, this TV is going to really start kicking in. And they're going to need product. Like today's streaming, they're desperate and need product to keep up. So he did the first film was called The Fugitive. Beautifully shot, beautifully acted, about a priest in a fictional Mexico country that forbids religion, and beautifully shot. My God, Dolores Del Rio never looked better. But it bombed at the box office, only made about $800,000. So right off the bat, Ford's company is $500,000 in debt to RKO because they had a 5-picture deal with RKO. So he turned what he knew best, went to the Western, and he took a short story from James Warner Bella called Massacre. And it's roughly a take on the Custer Little Bighorn story. And he started with that film, wanted to shoot it in Technicolor, but the budget wasn't there. So they had to do it in black and white. And it turned out to be quite successful and did quite well. Didn't quite get the company out of debt, but it got really great reviews and did very, very well at the box office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that movie kind of starts the whole thing about the landscape. And I guess Ford was already there with Stagecoach, but he in these three movies he really brings out again the landscape again.
Well, the landscape becomes part of the film. It's part of the character of the film, and he knew where to shoot, what time to shoot, and he loved that stuff. You know, he had a John Milius, the director, once said he had a love affair with Monument Valley, and it's very, very true. You see that in all his films.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, you know, we were talking, we watched those films. We went and watched all three of them, see, so we could be up to kind of up to date here. But I wonder, where is the water? You know, I those poor folks, you know.
Where did they get those canteens built? Yeah.
I have no idea. But there was a lot of things there, you know, that you kind of went, what did they do? You know, how was it out there?
Yeah.
It was very rough because where they were in Monument Valley, they had to live in tents. There were no motels around. So only tents. And your shower was a 5-gallon oil drum of cold water. So you took quick showers.
Yeah.
They were shooting in July in Monument Valley.
Uh-huh. Wow.
It was pretty brutal at times, and storms and that.
Yeah.
But he did. Oh. I got my Ben Johnson story.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
My Ben Johnson, I love this story. So Ben Johnson had come out Oklahoma because Howard Hughes had bought a bunch of horses from a ranch Ben was working at for his movie, The Outlaw. And when Ben got out here, he saw what he was making as a wrangler in Hollywood versus $30 a month in Oklahoma. It was no brainer for him to stay and pick up work. And he, you know, because he could ride, Dan Ford, John Ford's grandson said, and he's right, Ben Johnson was poetry on horseback. He was as a horseback rider to what Fred Astaire was to dancing, and he just made it look so damn easy. Well, Ben started getting work as a wrangler, as a stunt man. He did work for Ford on Three Godfathers. He had an unspoken part as a deputy of Ward Bond. So at Ford Apache, He did double Henry Fonda in several scenes on horseback. And so anyway, they're doing the scene where they were trying to pick up the dead soldiers' bodies and then repair the telephone wires. Well, what happens is the Apaches attack, so they have to take off. So the wagon is coming up this narrow road, and it makes a sharp left turn. And as it does, if you watch the film, you'll see that the left rear wheel goes up like this. And then it cuts to a wider shot of them racing through Monument Valley. What you didn't see is that wagon wheel didn't just lift off. The wagon flipped on its side. The driver lost control of the reins, and the horses are running wild. And you got three stuntmen in the wagon. And the horses are running right to a rock wall that if they hit the rock wall, the horses will be killed. Very certainly the stuntmen would be severely injured if not killed. Well, on all scenes with horses, you have wranglers or stuntmen who are called outriders. They're on horses. They're out of the camera range. And they're there. If something goes wrong, they can jump in. Well, Sven sees what happens, takes off. He gets to the left rear leader, stacks up the horses, meaning they banged into each other, but they weren't hurt. Excuse me. And saves the stuntman. Well, Ford gets off the camera platform. He walks by Ben. Yeah. Ben, you'll be well treated for this. So Ben figured, I'm going to get some more extra stunt work. A couple of days later, back at RKO Studios in Culver City, and he's summoned to Ford's office. Ford hands him a manila envelope that's open, says, have your attorney look at this. Since it's open, Ben pulls it out. It's his five-year contract with Ford's company. But I got down to the bottom of the first page where they said they'd pay me $5,000. He said, I took a pen right off of Ford's desk and signed it right there. And that's how Ben Johnson started his acting career, because his first role was in She Wore a Yellow Ribbon.
Yes. And he had a favorite horse, didn't he?
Yes. He had, well, his father-in-law, who owned Clarence Fat Jones, there were two big stables in the LA area at the time that if you were a filmmaker, you went to either one of them for horses, wagons, stagecoaches, harness, all that stuff. And there was Jones's stable and the Hudkins stable. So Ben married Clarence Jones's daughter, and he was the son-in-law. Well, he got to ride Steel. And in you see him ride Steel, and She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. And it was a beautiful horse. Ben handles them so well. Well, in 1953, Ben took a year off of acting and competed and won the world championship team roping belt buckle on Steel.
On Steel.
On Steel.
That's amazing.
Henry, do you have any comments on Fort Apache?
Well, actually, I was thinking about the whole trilogy and the value that Ford got by going back to Monument Valley again and again. We always are talking about the John Ford stock company, the actors that he uses over and over. But I was thinking about the locations and all of the Navajo actors that he used repeatedly. And I know, Michael, you know all about how he took advantage of in a positive way, of going back to
Monument
Valley again and again.
He dearly loved the Navajo, and there were two Navajo actors, John Stanley and Bob Many Mules. He would not do a film without them, nor would he do a film without Hosinso, who was better known as Fats. He wasn't fat. The Navajo name for that means big, a large man. He was very big, large man. He was not fat. But everyone nicknamed him Fats. And he was the medicine man. And Ford wouldn't do a film without any of those guys at all.
Yeah.
As well as all the other Navajos. He once said how when he came on the set the first day of a film, all the Navajo broke into song in their language, singing "Happy Days Are Here Again." He put them to work, and they made money.
You know,
they made a lot of good.
Yeah. We're going to take another very short, it's our last very short break. And when we come back, we're going to switch into She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. And this is a word from Blue Cottage Agency. We are so delighted that they're riding alongside of us as a sponsor of the show. And let's hear a little bit about Blue Cottage Agency, and we'll be right back. Rendezvous with a Writer is sponsored by Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison, your author publicity and book marketing team. Experience. Trusted, effective. Contact them today at bluecottageagency.com.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer with special guests Henry Park and Michael F. Blake. You know, we're about ready to talk about She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. But, Michael, give us just a little bit of info about Ford. Just what kind of guy was he to work with?
Boy, is that a
watching, I'm watching our time.
how long have you got?
2 minutes.
a master painter with a camera. Nobody caught better moments and visions of things, whether it was in Monument Valley or in a black and white film, than Ford did. He was just great. He could be cantankerous. He had a very gruff attitude that if you came up to him, he might bite your head off. That, and I once asked Harry Carey Jr. about that, and he said there could only be one captain on the ship.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he said that captain was John Ford. He didn't want other people coming around saying, well, I think like today, I've been on shows in the past where you got the director, but then the producer or producers suddenly come up and want to put their 5 cents in and ruin things. So Ford had this attitude that you didn't mess with him. Don't mess with him. The old man will bite your head off. My dad once said, because he worked for him twice, he said he was an SOB, but he was our SOB.
SOB, right.
And he hid the Irish sentiment behind this gruff exterior, but he really cared about a lot of people, although he'd never say it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But and I think he is the greatest director in American cinema, bar none.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he won 4 Academy Awards for directing. That's nobody else is to top that.
And 2 Oscars for best short subject during World War II.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's jump into She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. So, what, Henry? Do you have a question to ask Michael about this film?
Gosh, it's such a lovely film. It's hard to know where to start.
I know.
I was wondering why. Well, this is actually going to Rio Grande. I was wondering why Ford started the trilogy in black and white. Did She Wore a Yellow Ribbon in gorgeous Technicolor, and then ended with Rio Grande in black and white again?
Well, he wanted to do Fort Apache in color, but they, you know, Wayne was getting $10,000 a week for 10 weeks. Fonda was getting $10,000 a week for 10 weeks. And Shirley Temple was getting $10,000 a week for 10 weeks. So the money wasn't there. They couldn't do it because filming in Technicolor was expensive. The cameras back, you had to have a special camera and special film stock. So it was expensive. With Yellow Ribbon, the only big name he had in there that was making $10,000 a week was Wayne. Everybody else was not making that much, so they could afford it. Rio Grande, well, you had Skinflint Herbert Yates at Republic. And he...
How tight was he?
Well, he was... weak when he walked, you know. He was really bad. But I can tell you about that once we get into Rio Grande, why they didn't do it. It was budget. He didn't spend the money.
Yeah.
But, and if folks buy the new Blu-ray of She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, that's the restored print UCLA did just recently, a couple of years ago. And it's gorgeous, just flat out gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. You know? One of the things for our readers, this is a fascinating book. And we did watch the films with the book on our knees, reading along. Yeah. And I would say, wait a minute, this scene is, what's going on? That's not what's supposed to happen now. And then I would get to the end of Michael's writing about this particular scene. And he'd say, and that was all edited out, or that was all left on the cutting room floor. And then he'd go on with, and this is what you'll actually see.
Yeah.
So readers, you get an intimate backstory that is so wonderfully told. When Michael said writing with passion from the heart, you feel like you're sitting right with him and he is guiding you through this experience. And if you think you know these films, I would encourage you to pick up this book because you will get all kinds of additional information that you won't get from just watching the films. And a delight to read, Michael, an absolute delight to read.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I can't believe it. We're at 45 minutes into the show already. Oh, my goodness. So we probably are going to get to Rio Grande. What I would love you to share with us is, in all of your research, because you did tons, what was there something that really surprised you that was unexpected that you found?
Well, I learned that a very bad horse fall in Fort Apache changed the workman's comp laws in Arizona because if you got hurt, you got about 65-75% of your weekly salary. Well, stuntman John Hudkins was making a total of $800 a week in $1947. And he's doing the stunt where he gets shot off the horse and he's supposed to fall off the horse. Well, the horse tripped in a hole and went down on top of him, broke his back. And he was on disability for almost 10 months. And Arizona realized, my God, if John Wayne or Henry Fonda got hurt, and with what they get paid, we'll go broke. So they had to change the law, and it was named the Hudkins Law. The other thing I found during Rio Grande, there was no production papers available. They all just seemed to disappear, gone in the wind, unlike I had with Fort Apache and Yellow Ribbon. But I did have some things, but then what came to my rescue was I got copies of the Daily Independent weekly newspaper in Moab and found out a lot of things about what was going on there. One of the things turns out Ford put on a 3-night charity show for the Lions Christmas Club group where they had Maureen O'Hara came out and sang, the Sons of the Pioneers came out and sang. The stuntmen did a fake fight. Guys were doing J. Carroll Nash and Grant Withers did a dramatic one act about an aging Civil War soldier. Nobody I know ever mentioned this in any other book. And then a week later, Rex Allen brought his syndicated CBS show to Moab to do a recording in the high school auditorium. Audience invited in for free. The half-hour show, they had John Wayne, Maureen O'Hara, Vince McLaughlin, Sons of the Pioneers. When the taping was over, the Sons of the Pioneers continued to do a one-hour show for the audience for free.
Yeah. Michael, where can people find you, follow you, and such?
Well, I don't have a webpage anymore. It just didn't have time for it. I'm on Facebook. I have a Facebook page called John Ford's Cavalry Trilogy. Share photos and stories about the three films. And I'm on Facebook, Mike F. Blake. And like a bad penny, I'm always around.
And Henry, where can people find and follow you?
Well, the best places to find me, of course, my blog, Henry's Western Roundup. And also my Facebook page. You can always leave me a message there on the Henry's Western Roundup Facebook page.
Yeah. And Jim, you have a couple of quotes, I think.
We may get to
it
real quick.
I can't believe how fast our time's gone.
This is from Michael's book. Yeah. Carl Emily, the founder of Universal Studios. And the quote is, "That Jack Ford, he yells real loud. He'll make a good director."
Yeah.
And the other one is
right.
The other quote is from another John Ford movie, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Oh, yeah.
And Jimmy Stewart, one of the key characters, is talking to the reporter, and he's trying to set the reporter straight. This is the real story. So he tells him the real story. And the reporter says, "I'm not going to print it." And Jimmy Stewart's character says, "Well, why not?" And he says, "Well, you don't understand. This is the West, sir. When the legend becomes fact, print the legend."
One of the most famous quotes probably from any Western movie, right? Well, we really thank you so much, both of you, for joining us tonight. And this time just went so very, very fast. I just want to announce next week, we'll be rendezvousing with author Gina L. Carroll and talking about a brand new release of hers called The Grandest Garden. And we look forward to you being with us. Thank you for all of you that joined us tonight live or you're picking up the podcast. Thank you to Sam Hasson of LA Talk Radio. And
as we always say, it's always a great day out west.
Keep reading, keep writing. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, you.